Okay, be honest. Have you ever sat down with your morning coffee, fully convinced you're about to conquer the world, and then somehow found yourself scrolling, snacking, alphabetizing your inbox, and wondering why your brain feels like it's running dial-up internet? If that feels a little too relatable, listen up. Everyday Dose is coffee with benefits. It's the same delicious coffee you already love, plus lion's mane, collagen protein, chaga, and nootropics to help support focus, mood, and mental clarity. Imagine your morning cup not just waking you up, but helping your brain fire on all cylinders without the jitters, without the crash, and without the sudden urge to reorganize your sock drawer. And because the collagen is built right in, you're supporting smoother joints, stronger hair and nails, and healthier looking skin, all at the same time. Everyday Dose is coffee plus benefits. They combine high quality coffee with powerful ingredients like lion's mane, chaga, collagen protein, and nootropics to fuel your brain, boost focus, and give you clean, sustained energy all day long. It tastes just like coffee without the downside. No crash, no jitters, just clean, sustained energy. Right now, get 61% off your first Coffee Plus starter kit, free peppermint mocha creamer plus for the holidays, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/mindful or use code mindful at checkout.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays, decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa, got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments, Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels, Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
And one of the studies that we quote a lot was that people with acute back pain, you know, short-term injury-related, there's a certain area of the brain that lights up. And when that pain shifts into becoming chronic, the area of the brain shifts. And it shifts into areas that have to do with emotions and with the making of meaning about experiences. It's a completely different area than the area that's involved with acute pain. So this is these are real phenomena that, you know, when people say, do you think this is in my head? No, we don't. We think it's in the brain. There are physical, structural, real changes in the nervous system that affect signals coming down from the brain to the body and also the processing of signals that are coming from the body up to the brain.
Dr. David Clark, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
So I hope I get this right. You're the president of the Association for Treatment of Neuroplastic Symptoms.
Yep, that's right. Neuro for brain and nerves, and plastic for capacity for change, which makes it very hopeful. And those are symptoms that are real pain or illness, but not caused by organ disease or structural damage. And we teach healthcare professionals and the public what they can do to successfully alleviate those.
Okay. So issues that are caused from something that is not from tissue organs? Is that what you said?
That's right. Yeah. You know, for example, back pain is a very common one, and it can be quite severe, but it's not being caused by pinched nerves or by damage to the bones of the spine. It's actually being generated by the brain. And this is turns out to be incredibly common. It's about 1 in 4 adults, and it's 40% of people that go to see a doctor that are having these brain-to-body symptoms, which can be anywhere. It can be migraines, dizziness, ringing in the ears, visual problems, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel, pelvic, bladder, genital pain, abdominal, chest pain, spine, you know, either the neck or the back is a big one, chronic fatigue, long COVID. I mean, the list just goes on and on, but they're very real. They can be severe. They can put people in the hospital. They can be debilitating for years or even decades, but they're linked to stress, which causes physical changes in the nerve pathways of the brain. Stress in your life right now, stress from the past, experiences as kids that my patients would never want for a child of their own, for example. Emotions can be involved, especially those that are not recognized by the patient themselves. Other challenges in life. These can happen to anybody, no matter, you know, how mentally strong you are. If there's enough stress going on, it can create these problems.
That's interesting. Yeah, I'd like to hear more about the mechanics there. But I guess first, I saw in your bio, your background is a GI doc, correct?
That's right. I was very traditionally trained. I went through 7 years of perfectly straightforward Western style medical education, and never heard a word about any of this. So in my 8th year, I encountered a patient that I didn't know the first thing about diagnosing or treating, which, when you get to the 8th year, especially when you've been successful, which I had been, I got an award for diagnostic excellence in medical school. So to get to year 8 and have a patient that I had no clue what was going on, that was a kind of a shock. But this was a woman in her late 30s who was averaging one bowel movement per month for 2 years.
Oh, you
Yeah,
said one a
exactly.
month?
One a month. She was taking 4 different laxatives at double the recommended doses every single day and wasn't working. She had already been checked out by another university. She was sent to us at UCLA because we did some specialized testing. That was normal also. And I was just doing her exit interview and saying, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to live with this. But we kept talking, and eventually she trusted me enough to tell me that she had been severely abused as a girl. This was 25 years in the past. I didn't think it would be connected to her condition, but it gave me an excuse to get her connected with a psychiatrist named Harriet Kaplan, who was certified in medicine and had an interest in these brain-to-body conditions, which I was not familiar with. It's kind of embarrassing to admit that, but 7 years of training, nobody mentioned it. Anyway, I didn't think anything more about it. I went on with my training as a gastroenterologist until 3 months later, I run into Harriet in the elevator ride that changed my career, because between the ground floor and the 5th floor, she tells me that she has cured this patient with about 10 weeks of counseling sessions.
No kidding.
And that just shocked me that you could alleviate a serious medical condition just by talking to somebody. And I thought, okay, if I want to be a complete doctor, I should at least learn a little bit about this. So I had Harriet teach me her basic framework over the last year and a half of my education, and didn't think I'd use it more than once or twice a year, but I started asking the questions she had taught me anytime I had a patient whose tests were normal. And these issues, stress in the past, stress in the present, kept coming up over and over, 5 or 6 patients a week. So sitting here today, it's 40 years later, I've seen over 7,000 of these patients, successfully diagnosed and treated them. They're not always as severe as that very first one. Some of them very simple.
So when you say diagnose, is the diagnosis just stress, like
Find the
chronic stress?
stress. Find
Gotcha.
the stress. I do what I call a stress evaluation. It's a very step-by-step, organized process to look into all the different issues that can make people physically ill. And sometimes, like I say, very simple. There was one gentleman, and none of his other doctors, he'd been going to doctors for 8 or 9 months, had asked him this, but it turned out that he only got his pain when he was driving to work. When he was driving home from work, he was fine. So, the natural follow-up question is, okay, what's going on at work? And he had a massive stress there. He worked in a two-person office in a big company, and his partner was shipped 1,500 miles to the east. And so instantly his workload doubled. And very soon after that, he started getting these stomach pains when he was driving to work. My physician colleagues, excellent training, they were focused on, okay, what's wrong with his body? Let's do CAT scans and endoscopies and ultrasounds and blood tests and find out what's wrong with his organs and structures. That wasn't where the problem was. So once he recognized what was happening, he went to his supervisor, he got some changes because they were having trouble hiring a replacement for the guy they shipped out. They made some changes in his work obligations, pain went away.
That's crazy. On that first client that you mentioned, the girl that had some trauma and then 25 years of, I guess, severe constipation,
No, she was
or
actually had no symptoms until 2 years before. This can happen quite commonly, that people who went through childhood trauma, and it doesn't have to be severe, you know, abuse like that woman suffered. It can be much more subtle than that. It can be things that make you feel like a second-rate human being, for example. But sort of ironically, as part of the recovery process, people can reach a stage where the emotions start to bubble up and want to be felt and heard and expressed. And if you're not capable of that, the emotions will just say, okay, we're going to express ourselves via your body. And so, it can cause symptoms anywhere.
So that's basically, on some level, you're like the nervous system runs the show, I guess, and you're just stuck in the, like, stuck in that fight or flight where things like digestion just kind of shut down.
Yeah, it was 35% of my patients. The other 65%, you know, organ disease, structural damage, ulcers, tumors, gallstones, all those kinds of things, inflamed pancreas. But 35% of my patients had none of that. But, you know, they had symptoms.
Well, those other
their tests were normal.
The other ones that have all the tissue damage, I mean, who's to say there wasn't a stress at the heart of that also?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are good studies now that show that peptic ulcer is linked to the H. pylori bacterium, but lots of people have the H. pylori bacterium. It's close to half the urban adult population, and only a fraction get the ulcers. Why is it that only some people get the ulcers? Is there a genetic vulnerability in the lining of their stomach, perhaps? But stress also could be a factor.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been shown pretty clearly that any chronic stress will alter the microbiome to some degree, which is essentially, I guess, what's happening if you have H. pylori, if you have a bacteria that's pathogenic, that's more than you want. Like, it wasn't always like that. Something created that shift.
Yeah. Well, and the fight or flight nervous system is very much involved with the GI tract. I mean, the number of nerves in the GI tract is similar to the number of nerves in the spinal cord. So it's, you know, 5 or 10% as many as there are in the brain. It's a huge number of nerves. And when the person is experiencing a stress that clicks on their fight or flight system, those nerve impulses go into the GI tract and they change the muscle contractions, and that can cause symptoms. If you've got your large intestine and it's spasming, that can be quite painful. And it can also cause either diarrhea or constipation, depending on whether the contractions are propulsive or stationary.
So what about, like you mentioned, back pain? Most adults experience back pain at some point in their life. And I mean, I have a family member, my father, who has had back pain forever. And now it's hard to avoid because he's had so many surgeries. You don't know how much pain is from the surgeries and all the crap and hardware they put in there. He was unfortunately, a guinea pig over the years, I feel like. But at the source of it, I assume there was some emotional stress stuff. And I've noticed over the years that if he changes his environment, and he, particularly if he's around people that, like his cousins that he was very close with at early age, like people that bring him back in time, it seems like the pain doesn't affect him the same way.
Interesting?
It's like a psychological connection to life before the pain was there.
Yeah, that's a good example of the power of the brain to influence what is being felt in the body. The spine is a particularly problematic area because it turns out that when you do x-rays or MRIs of people whose backs feel fine, you know, they've got no symptoms, no pain, but you do an x-ray of the back just to see, you know, what does it look like? Does it look healthy? Does it look normal? It turns out it doesn't. It turns out over half the people over the age of 40 and a large fraction of people younger than 40 have abnormalities in their spine. So, and then they feel fine. It's just a sort of a part of the normal aging process. So if you have somebody that goes to see a physician because their back is hurting and they do an x-ray or MRI and they see an abnormality, the logical conclusion is that, well, that abnormality that we're seeing there must be causing your pain. But that's not necessarily true. It could be just an incidental finding, part of your normal aging process, and having nothing whatsoever to do with what's causing your pain, which is actually getting brain generated. And typically people that do procedures on painful spines, and whether they're, you know, injections or nerve ablations or surgery, they're not doing a careful stress evaluation to see what's going on in somebody's life. They're just, you know, as I was trained and most physicians are trained, if there's an abnormal organ or structure and there's pain there, it must be that the two are connected. And turns out that in a study just a couple years ago, they did very careful evaluations. They did do the stress evaluation, and they found that 88% of people with spine pain, it was brain generated. It was neuroplastic. If your listeners are interested in their own symptoms, we've got a 12-question self-assessment quiz on symptomatic.me that people can take. And the more questions to which they answer yes, the more likely it is that there's a neuroplastic process contributing to their condition.
So basically, the brain itself is providing you pain for a reason, to try to tell you something. And hopefully we would listen. Like, and we understand this on a basic level, like you put your hand on the stove and you learn really quickly how to change behavior. But we don't think about it in the chronic sense. Like,
that's right.
My shoulder is hurting every time I raise my arm or whatever. And it's a long gap between a recognition of like how to change behavior if there's something there. I mean, do we know what part of the, not we, I mean, is it known what part in the brain that this is being modulated?
Yes. Yes, I mean, the best studies come from Chicago. A researcher named Apkarian is associated with a lot of these. And one of the studies that we quote a lot was that people with acute back pain, you know, short-term, injury-related, there's a certain area of the brain that lights up. And when that pain shifts into becoming chronic, which, you know, a certain significant fraction of people with acute pain, short-term pain, it becomes chronic, lasting for longer than, say, 3 months, the area of the brain shifts. It shifts into areas that have to do with emotions and with the making of meaning about experiences. It's a completely different area than the area that's involved with acute pain. So these are real phenomena that, you know, when people say, do you think this is in my head? No, we don't. We think it's in the brain. There are physical, structural, real changes in the nervous system that affect signals coming down from the brain to the body, and also the processing of signals that are coming from the body up to the brain. And the combination of this is what produces the pain or illness. But by identifying sources of stress that are going on in a person's life and addressing those, people get better. One of my patients was, you know, just to cite an extreme example, had unexplained abdominal pain for 79 years. And once the issue was identified and addressed, within 3 or 4 months, it was almost completely gone.
Wow. So do you feel like you have to re-educate the nervous system, or do you just have to, or in your experience, do you just have to like get to that root cause stress, take that stress out, and then everything falls back in place? Like, does the nervous system have to be convinced on some level that like it can go back to being the healthy way?
Well, it's convincing when we identify stresses in a person's life and we help people to make some changes and they start to see improvement in their symptoms. And typically, these are people that nothing has worked for them. They've tried supplements and pharmaceuticals and manual therapies like acupuncture or massage. They've sometimes tried invasive treatments like injections or nerve ablations. Some of them have had surgery, like your dad. So they've tried typically a lot of stuff, and then they try the identification and addressing of the stress, and they start to see improvement for the first time, and that's very convincing. And so they keep following down that path.
What was the case of that patient you just alluded to, the one that had an issue for 79 years?
When she was 6 years old, she was growing up on a farm in rural Idaho, and this was in the 1920s. And a new baby was born in the family, and parents were really busy running the farm, so she was given charge of the baby. And she took care of that kid 7 days, you know, 24/7, like another little girl would take care of a doll. She, you know, fed the baby, slept with it, changed it, dressed it, played with it. And this went on for 2.5 years. And then tragically, the baby, or now a toddler, developed appendicitis. And we're, you know, 1923 in rural Idaho. Child did not survive. She felt horrible personal responsibility for this as now an 8-year-old who had somehow been allowed this baby to die. And she began having stomach pains soon thereafter. She tried to cope with this by taking care of children on neighboring farms. She chose as her career to become a pediatric nurse. She had 4 children of her own and raised them very carefully, as you might guess, but all the time this pain is going on. And she's a nurse. She's in the middle of the healthcare system. She gets, you know, full diagnostic evaluation. She had given up. Her son brought her in. Her son hadn't given up. He was distressed by his mother's ongoing pain. Brings her in at age 87. And, you know, when she told me that the pain started when she was 8, I just asked her, what happened when you were 8? And she told me the story about the her, you know, little brother who died, and clearly carrying the guilt. So her treatment was to write a letter to the baby brother.
Interesting.
And express her thoughts, her feelings, her emotions, and to understand how much guilt she had been carrying. One of the elements of the story, and she remembered this after, you know, 79 years, she's telling me that at the funeral, the whole town gathers in the church, and she's in a state of shock. And her uncle points out to the congregation, you know, look, she's the only one who isn't crying. And it just made her guilt level go off the charts that, you know, everybody else is crying because of this toddler who's passed away, and she's not crying. And she's not crying because she's in shock. But she felt like, you know, I must not care as much as everybody else. And that just multiplied the burden she was carrying. But once, you know, we brought this into conscious awareness that she'd been carrying all this, gave her a chance to take these thoughts and emotions and put them into words in the form of a letter to the deceased toddler. You know, she was probably 70% better in 3 or 4 months.
That's an amazing story. The organization you work with, like, I don't understand, how is that implemented? How does somebody get, how are you reaching someone like that? Are you just broadly educating physicians, or?
Well, we first want to let everybody know that the brain is capable of causing severe pain or illness in the body, absolutely real pain or illness in the body. Just that one idea, you know, so that we're not always fixated on the organs and structures, that we know there's another possibility and that we need to diagnostically investigate it just the way we would anything else. And you know, what stresses is the person going through in their life right now? Is there a connection, a linkage between when and where the symptoms are happening and when and where the stresses are happening? One of my patients, you know, they started sending me mystery cases that were not gastrointestinal in nature once my interest in this condition got known in my medical community. And they sent me a gentleman who had daily low back pain for over 25 years. You know, his spine x-ray didn't look that bad, and nobody could figure out why he was so severely afflicted. Well, it turned out that he didn't have it every single day. There were 2 weeks out of the year when he felt fine. And you can probably guess what he was doing during those 2 weeks out of the year. He was on vacation. And so I I didn't want to jump to conclusions. So I said, are you lying on a warm beach somewhere, carefully resting your back, and that's why it feels fine? I said, no. He was fly fishing in British Columbia. So he's wading out into the river. He's twisting back and forth with the fly rod. He's bending over to pick up the fish. And then he tells me at the end of the day, he helps the lodge owner clear brush from behind the lodge. Is he having any pain when he's doing this? Not a bit. But as soon as he gets back home to his highly stressful lifestyle, in which he was, constantly working hard on behalf of everybody else, never taking a break. That was just the way he lived. Many of my patients are like this. They take care of everybody else in their world, but they just can't put themselves on the list of people they take care of. They take no time for their own joy, except, those 2 weeks. And his treatment recommendation was to, you got to find something that's the equivalent of fly fishing that you can do every week. And he struggled with that, to be honest, but that was clearly going to be the path that would lead to relief for him. So stress in your life right now, stress when you were a kid, something that happened that, if you were watching your own child go through the same stuff, it would make you sad or angry.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. Yeah, I mean, I got sick with Lyme disease a few years back, 2017. And one thing I learned through that process, and it was a really stressful time, that a lot of people walk around with Lyme disease and they're fine until like a divorce or a loss of a loved one, some kind of other trigger.
Yeah. And there's another issue there as well that, you can have the antibodies to Lyme even after it's been successfully treated. And so if you start getting symptoms and there's no explanation for them and they're connected to stress and somebody does a blood test on you to see if you've got antibodies to Lyme, and sure enough, you've had Lyme in the past, it's been successfully treated and eradicated, but you've still got the antibodies. And so they say, aha, you've got chronic Lyme. And it turns out not to be a real entity. That may not have been what you had, but there are Lyme doctors, quote unquote, out there that will treat you with massive amounts of antibiotics. And that's not where the real problem is. That's coming about from that same logical error of attributing your symptoms that, that they must be due to some kind of organ disease, infection, structural abnormality, and leaving out this essential stress evaluation that I do and that we teach others to do.
Can you touch on that evaluation a little bit more, more detail, what it looks like?
The stress in your life right now, then I'll ask people, what would it be like for you to watch your own child or a child you care about growing up the way you did? Was there anything that happened to you that would make you sad or angry to imagine happening to a kid you care about? And that often leads into very productive discussions. And it's only a minority that had the really severe, the abuse, the physical or sexual abuse or violence in the home, or one of the parents being a serious alcoholic or substance abuser. Many of the patients grew up in seemingly much more benign situations where there was nevertheless something difficult or toxic going on. Person I interviewed for my podcast, which is called The Story Behind the Symptoms, where I interview patients, her parents didn't like her to express negative emotions, so that whenever she had a negative emotion, they encouraged her to not feel it. Sometimes if she couldn't handle that, they would send her to her room, and they made it very clear, take those negative emotions and get rid of them somehow. And so she ended up growing up without access to those emotions, which are a very important signal to us about what's going on in the world and how we feel about it. And if you don't have those emotions, it leads to making poor decisions for yourself, poor decisions in your relationships, poor decisions for your career. And when you make those, the stress level goes up and up and up. Physical symptoms then kick in. She had physical symptoms for 16 years. She made a terrible career choice. Her personal close relationships were with toxic people that didn't give back to her nearly as much as she was giving to them. But, you know, when you look back on it, a lot of people think, well, you know, that was just the way my family was. And they don't see necessarily how difficult it was.
It's hard to see it on yourself. It's interesting.
We don't have a parallel life to compare ourselves with.
It's very interesting. It sounds like a very powerful framework, the way you phrase it as, you know, if it would, like, if you would be upset seeing this happen to, like, a child that you care about, like that, where you, where somebody could, it's like a weird version of a mirror. Like, can you step out of your own system? Can you let the fish see that there's what, you know,
that's
understand
right.
what the water is or whatever, by like imagining it more outwardly towards someone else that you care about?
I have so many patients who've said, you know, I went through some stuff when I was a kid, but it wasn't that bad. Other people have been through worse.
It's all relative.
I think I'm over it now. But again, we don't have a parallel life right. to compare ourselves with. So whatever we look back on, that largely feels normal to us.
Right.
One of my patients, the issue was that her parents fought with each other on an almost a daily basis, verbally and emotionally, not physically. And she was the only child, and she played the role of peacemaker. And she tried really hard to, you know, get her parents to stop fighting. And she failed almost every day. And so she felt like a failure, and her self-esteem suffered. And she was telling me this story, but at the same breath was saying, you know, it really wasn't that big a deal. Until I asked her to imagine a beloved child that she spent a lot of time with, to imagine that 5 or 6-year-old in the household with her parents, while she herself is just a butterfly on the wall, having to watch this beloved younger child try to cope. What would that be like for you, I asked her, you know, for this child to be there for a week or so, and that you can't do anything about it, you just have to watch. And she just stared at me. She was a very verbal person, talked a lot, but when I had her start thinking about this thought experiment, she just stopped and stared. And a couple of minutes went by, and then at the end she said, after a week of that, I would shoot myself. And yeah. that was the first time she recognized just how difficult it had been.
Yeah, it's weird. Like the stress is, it's relative. Like the most stressful thing to happen to you is the most stressful thing to happen to you. So even though someone else might say, well, that's not as bad as, you know, dot, 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 to the nervous system, the felt experience, it doesn't necessarily matter if it's you, you know, an issue like that where you're playing a role in your family that you didn't really sign up for, or you're in a trench and there's bombs flying overhead. It's like, it's a very blunt object our nervous system has to work with. It's like, well, we'll flip on these switches and turn these stress hormones on and turn down these, you know, steroid hormone, these other hormones. And that's what we got to work with. The stress could come in all different forms. It could be infection too. It could be environmental stuff. It's like, so it can manifest in all these physical things, but regardless of what the stress is, it's just a very blunt object that our body has to try to manage it and like meet that demand in the moment of whatever that stress is at the expense of whatever downstream over time is going to happen. Like we know chronic stress is associated with everything that ails us, with everything that takes us out.
That's right. Yeah. And it took me a long time when I was back in early in my career, when I was still learning about this, to realize that the stresses like the one I just described with the parents fighting with each other could be every bit as damaging long term as the more obvious forms of abuse. You know, people who've been through physical or sexual abuse or had a parent who was an alcoholic, you know, those kinds of very obvious dysfunctionalities. But these more subtle things where kids are made to feel like, you know, you're not good enough, you're not measuring up, you're a second-rate person, you're a worthless person. Those get carried well into the adult years. They turn people into, as a child, you try to fight back against that by becoming the best little kid you can be. by people pleasing, by being very self-critical, by being a perfectionist, by being extremely compassionate towards others, by not taking time for your own joy, but instead focusing on the needs of everybody else. This is how a kid will try to cope with an environment like that. And it can be, you know, equally damaging if the issues in the family are more emotional than physical. And these personality traits that people carry into the adult years, they are highly stressful enough to cause physical reactions in the body that can be quite debilitating.
Through this process, David, have you, and you know, if you're not comfortable sharing, that's understandable, but have you kind of unlocked any insights about your own self and the connection of your mind and emotional state and your physical well-being by like witnessing all these stories around you?
Well, I was very fortunate, you know, not to grow up with the kinds of problems that occur in my patients. In many ways, this was a handicap to me learning about this. You know, there are a lot of people who work in this field who have overcome these what we call adverse childhood experiences themselves, and it gives them insight into the people that they work with. I was starting from ground zero. I mean, that very first patient, when she told me that her father had molested her, you know, hundreds of times, I'd never heard a story like that from a patient before. I didn't think it could cause a physical reaction like that. And it was probably a 5-year process for me to learn about this, 250 or 300 patients a year. I know I made a lot of mistakes in the early years. I especially missed the emotions that people had. This is a big part of my stress evaluation is, do you have anger, fear, shame, grief, guilt that you're not consciously aware of? And that thought experiment of watching a kid you care about growing up in the same household you did, that can help connect people with their emotions and help them to feel what they can feel about watching the kid. They can then transfer to recognizing how they feel about themselves. I was lucky that I didn't have to go through these experiences, but it definitely extended my learning process.
That's interesting. You're lucky so far. Maybe you'll uncover something yet.
I can tell you it did help me with raising my kids. I'm a very detail-oriented person in the workplace, but I found that with raising my kids, you don't want to be detail-oriented. I tried to make my home, and I learned this from my patients and having them describe their own childhood experiences and what worked for them and what didn't work for them. And I tried to make our home and my wife as well an oasis of support for them. Because, you know, when they, especially as teenagers, they go out in the world, there are lots of different ways in which they're getting a message that they're not measuring up in some way or other, yeah, academically or athletically or,
or
in their clothes.
Social
or their
media now.
Their appearance. Yeah, it's just really, really tough on teenagers today. So I wanted, when they got home, I didn't want to be just one more source of negativity. And I just tried to notice when they did something well and let them know that I noticed. That was pretty much the shift that I made. And I think it was very important. Kids are amazing today.
Yeah. And, you know, parenting is hard. And I mean, I kind of believe it's impossible not to screw up your kids, no matter your intentions.
Parenting is too difficult to do perfectly. We're all going to make mistakes.
Right. Yeah, I think back, my parents split up when I was young, and they didn't fight a lot. I remember having a couple memories come up where you'd see them fighting, but it was really minimal. Like, it was like one or two memories. But afterwards, they separated, and for some reason, for the longest time, I just assumed they'd get back together. Like, even into, they separated when I was like 4 or 5, even in like as a late teenager, I still assumed it. I don't know where that came from, but why I couldn't like see the reality. But one thing that I had a couple older sisters that I recently got insight into is I was always, there was like this, I won't say they were sides, but it was kind of like my mom and my sisters on one side and my father on the other. And I found myself as like a buffer and always defending the other. So I would always like have to explain to my mom and sisters that their interpretation of something my dad did wasn't accurate. It didn't line up with his intention, and then vice versa. Like I was trying to like be the glue to hold it together so they could get back together. And recently on a podcast, somebody shed some insight for me that I must have felt that was like an existential threat for me. Like the tribe, like we're a tribal species and you needed your tribe to survive. If you wanted to survive, like you needed to be in a tribe and the tribe had to be together. And it was like I was bearing the load of keeping it together. And if I failed, it was a death on some level. It was like a death of my family, death of my tribe, and ultimately maybe a death for me.
Just, you know, recognize the magnitude of that burden. And especially when you're not successful.
Right.
You know, kids will, you know, find themselves on treadmills that they never get off trying to solve those problems. Other patients of mine have been in situations where bad things happened, but not all the time. Just sort of randomly that they couldn't predict, like it might, you know, a fight between the parents or getting molested by a parent or beaten by a parent or, you know, having some nasty thing said to them that wounded their self-esteem, but not all the time, just randomly. But it makes kids have to be vigilant all the time and try to be perfect all the time to avoid these things happening. And then when they happen anyway, you know, it's like living in a minefield where some days you're walking through the field and everything's fine. And another day you're walking through the same field and something blows up. And so that constant vigilance and the constant reminder that you're not successful, that you're a failure, just cranks up the energy that kids put into trying to be perfect and compassionate and pleasing to others. Not putting themselves on the list of people they take care of.
Yeah, I can see that. So, David, you were a GI doc that discovered all this by chance. Did you abandon that? Are you still in the GI business?
I was in the GI business until 2009, and I felt like I had done everything that I could do as a one-on-one practitioner. And I met some other people that were doing this work as well from around the country. And we created the nonprofit Association for Treatment of Neuroplastic Symptoms, incorporated in 2011. And we've been going ever since. We had an international conference in late September of 2025, 350 people from around the world, everywhere from New Zealand to Israel. We've got podcasts. We're going to add a third one in January. We have courses for professionals, courses for patients. We have recommended resources created by others, including apps and books, videos, all kinds of things to educate healthcare professionals and the public.
What are some of the steps on the healing? So obviously, you know, you have the questionnaire. So there's awareness is the first step on some level where somebody shines a light on, oh, yeah, maybe that is affecting me, that, you know, thing that happened when I was younger or whatever. Then what?
Yeah, the first thing we want people to do is to recognize that if they've been through the diagnostic tests and their doctor's not finding a physical cause, then that's great. That's excellent news. Even if you're in really severe pain or debilitated, the fact that your body appears to be okay means that you don't have to fear being permanently disabled. It means that this is almost certainly a brain-to-body condition.
So that's an empowering thing because of the plasticity,
it's a treatable condition. I mean, you know, that woman for 79 years, another patient of mine I was asked to see on hospital day 70, a 17-year-old girl getting unexplained abdominal pain, getting morphine in massive doses around the clock over the 2 years that she'd had the pain, she had seen six other GI doctors. She was successfully treated as well. She was off of out of the hospital in a week and off of all opioids in 30 days after we met. So even seemingly hopeless cases can be successfully treated with this approach. So the first step, though, is to shift your attention from the place where you're feeling the symptoms to your brain and start thinking about, you know, start lower the fear level about what's happening in your body. Try to, you know, minimize that. Yes, notice the symptoms, be aware of the symptoms, but take the emotions out of it and start thinking about, okay, what's going on in my brain, what's going on in my life, what was going on when I was growing up, and start thinking about those things. And many people, once they shift their attention, they start to figure it out just from that. Others, they need more help. They need to connect with emotions. I've had many patients over the years who've got way more anger inside, for example, than they realize, or shame, grief, guilt.
Shame's a tough one.
Those kinds of things. Fear. One of my patients who had the fear issue, it completely paralyzed his stomach. Not the abdomen, but the organ of digestion. We have a special test that we do to see, is this, you know, the stomach grinds up the food and sends it on into your intestine. Was his stomach doing that? He was throwing up. His endoscopy test, where we looked in there for ulcers, so that was normal. So we tested the muscle contractions of his stomach with this special test. His stomach was just sitting there. It wasn't contracting at all. They called me from the lab and they said, "We've been scanning this guy's stomach for 2 hours and nothing has moved. How much longer do you want us to scan him?" And I said, "We have our answer. It's not moving." And it turned out to all be from a severe source of fear that he had in his life.
So you connect with those emotions, and then what?
Well, when the emotions are understood and felt, then we can start talking about them. We can put them into words. We can have people, for example, if you have emotions around mistreatment as a kid, you know, anger about a person who mistreated you as a child, somebody you may still have positive feelings towards, somebody you may still care about, which makes it all that much more difficult when you've got anger at that same person. So one of the exercises I have people do is to write a letter that they don't mail it, but they write it to the parent who mistreated them. One of my patients took that letter and to his father's grave and spent 4 or 5 hours, he told me, reading it to him. And by the end, he was shouting. But after he did that, his physical symptoms were 90% better. So you're converting the bodily expression of emotion, what we call the somatic expression of emotion, into verbal expression. And the more you put it into words, written on a piece of paper, typed on a computer screen, spoken into a recording device, just some way of putting those emotions into words, the less they need to go into your body.
That's fascinating, the power of writing it down.
Yeah. The gentleman with the paralyzed stomach, we just had a conversation where we uncovered what the stress was, what the fear was coming from, helped him to understand this was something he did not need to fear, and he left the hospital the next day.
Are there any other strategies that, like, stick out as really powerful?
Yes. A lot of people need to set boundaries around a toxic individual, usually a parent, that is still in their life. A patient, my first book is called They Can't Find Anything Wrong. The first story in that book is a woman who was hospitalized at a prestigious university 60 times in 15 years for attacks of severe dizziness and vomiting that would go on for, you know, up to 4 days. And she had seen a dozen specialists down there. No diagnosis for this. You know, I had every test you can think of, some of them more than once. They got so frustrated, they had a psychiatrist interview her, and he pronounced her mentally healthy. Unfortunately, most mental health professionals are not trained in what to look for in people who are physically ill as opposed to having mental health symptoms. So this psychiatrist, unfortunately, completely missed what was going on. And what was going on was that all of her attacks, to make a long story short, were connected directly or indirectly to interactions with her abusive mother. Her mother had been verbally and emotionally abusive towards her starting at age 3 or 4. And now the patient is 50 years old. Mother is in her 70s. Mother is still doing it to this patient. And one of the clues that kind of cracked the case was that she would always get one of her attacks whenever she passed through a little town about 40 miles from where she lived. But the only time she went through this town was when she was on her way pretty much for her annual visit to her mom. So she's getting in the car, her husband's driving. She starts thinking about how horrible this upcoming visit with mom is going to be. And by the time they get 40 miles down the road, the dizziness is struck and she has to, be vomiting all over the guardrail. Her husband pulls the car over. And she never put it together that the only time she's going through this town is when she's on her way to visit mom. And I pointed this out to her and she said, oh, I don't really think that's it. Mom is just mom and I just deal with her. And
that's funny.
I said, well, okay, well, what happens if you drive 40 miles in some other direction and you're not going to visit mom? And that was her light bulb moment, because she could drive 140 miles. As long as she wasn't going to visit mom, she'd be fine. And I can still remember, she looked up at the ceiling and said, oh my God, I can't believe it. And her husband at that point, when he hears this, he's been sitting there staring at his shoes the whole time. And he looks up and he says, she used to get a lot of her attacks after she would talk to her mother on the phone. And in her case, just bringing this into conscious awareness, just having that conversation, just making it clear that there was a lot of emotions in there, mostly anger, and that she needed to set some boundaries around this woman.
So what does that look like?
She was gone the next day too.
What do you recommend when somebody does feel like they have someone in their life? Like I said, it's probably a parent or something. That's the thing. It's like it's a loved one. It's someone that you don't want to never have a relationship with. What does it look like tactically, to implement a boundary? Is it like you don't answer the phone when they call, you call back so it's on your terms? Is it, waiting 24 hours to respond to a text to
Yeah, it's very individual. Everybody has to do some experimentation to find out what's going to work for them. Part of it is just recognizing that nobody deserves to be physically ill because of a loved one in their life. And just, when the body is reacting, it's because the mind is in distress. And you have to listen to that communication from your mind, that these physical symptoms are a form of communication. Many of my patients, once they learn these approaches, they actually regard their physical symptoms as a useful signal. That there's something happening in their life that needs to be addressed. And the patients themselves need to experiment a bit, trial and error, to find a level of boundary setting that will eliminate the symptoms, basically. And that, is highly variable from person to person. One extreme, a patient of mine just cut off all contact for 6 months. Just said, I am not talking to this person on the phone. I'm not going to see them. I don't want to hear them in any way, shape, or form, directly or indirectly. Just completely eliminated this person from her life for 6 months. And as far as I know, that worked well for her. Other people, they're still interacting, but they're doing it on a more limited basis. And they're definitely not tolerating abusive language. If they're getting something from the parent or whoever it is that is going to make them suffer physically, they're just not tolerating that, and they leave or end the phone call or whatever it is.
And then how do you know when it's, let's say you say, okay, I really recognize how this relationship or this person affects me, and I have to take good care of myself and create a boundary like this. And how do you know when it's safe to like lower the fence?
Yeah, it's part of the process of healing from this is accurately realizing how much you've been through and giving yourself some credit for that.
Hello, it's Les here. I want to offer my sincere gratitude to you for tuning in. I know there are seemingly infinite options to place your attention these days, and I am humbled that you chose to spend this time with me. I also want to let you know that I am opening up a few more online private coaching sessions. I've been coaching clients for over 17 years, and I've always found it very rewarding to guide someone through a transformational phase of their life. If you would like to play a larger role in your sense of well-being, feel better in your body, and support your own healing or growth journey, please check out my services at themindfulmovement.com/less to see if we would be a good fit.
That same experiment of imagining yourself a butterfly on the wall and watching a kid you care about go through everything you did. Part of the purpose of that is to recognize the heroic perseverance that so many of my patients had as kids to get through those experiences and to give themselves the credit they deserve for having overcome all of that and to internalize the self-esteem that comes along with that. An analogy that I often use is that many of my patients, it was as if they were parachuted into a dangerous jungle as a toddler. Through no fault of their own, they find themselves in this highly challenging environment. And yet, they somehow made it through. And they deserve to give themselves tremendous credit, just as they would for a child of their own in that environment who survived it even for a week. They would be hugging that kid and saying, you know, great job. You know, this was really tough, but you made it. Well, that's just for a week. Most of my patients have been in these environments for, you know, in round numbers, 1,000 weeks. So they should give themselves tremendous credit. And the reason that's important is that once you've internalized that belief in your own quality, it makes it a lot easier to be strong when you set boundaries and to be able then later on to experiment with, well, maybe I'm going to relax these boundaries a little bit. And, you know, maybe the person you've set the boundaries around has learned a little bit from the experience. And if you've got that internal confidence, that internal sense of your own value, it's going to make it much easier for you to set boundaries that work for you.
Gotcha. As a former GI doc, I mean, I know you're probably biased, but I would assume just from the experience of I've had personally and people I know that GI distress is probably such a good indicator. Like as soon as a stress happens, I find that you might not be able to predict which direction it goes, but something's going to change. There will be like a change in GI function, you know?
Yeah. I mean, most people have had the experience of feeling a knot in their abdomen when they're in a tense situation, you know, whatever it is, a job interview or an athletic competition, and you want to do well and you're not sure you are going to do well and you feel that little knot in there. That's a classic brain to body reaction. Blushing with embarrassment is another one, brain to body. We've all had these. This form of illness is just a more extreme version of that. But yeah, because of the extremely extensive, dense nerve connections that come, you know, from the brain down the vagus nerve and all over the GI tract, it's very well wired to be impacted by stress in our lives. But like I say, it can be head to toe, you know, migraines and fatigue and brain fog and visual disturbances and neurological disorders, certain kinds of rashes even. The only common denominator is that my patients tend to have more than one symptom at a time. We just did a national survey where we found that the average number of symptoms of people likely to have this was 2.8. So it's quite common to have, you know, the brain sending signals out lots of different places.
And I guess it could be kind of muddy waters too, because you could have other issues. Like, let's say you have a GI issue, and maybe you get some tests and there are issues. Like, there are bacteria stuff or parasite stuff or candida or whatever, and you have these physical expressions, like, let's say it's a rash or brain fog or whatever. It doesn't mean that the thing on the lab is the real root cause. That just might essentially be a byproduct of you are stressed. And when you are stressed, all these, like, it affects your immune system. So if you have an opportunistic microorganism, it might flourish in that environment. So if you go chasing that with, you know, an antifungal or antimicrobial, whatever, herb or pharmaceutical, you might not get lasting relief, because it's there because of that underlying stress also. Like, I could see that people could be easily thrown in different directions trying to chase because of the symptoms and not realizing that there might be something underneath it all that is more emotionally linked, that is just setting the tone of the whole nervous system. Like, the whole nervous system's not in a happy place. So,
that's right.
So you could have all these blood tests or other ailments that could really throw you on a bunch of dead ends, essentially.
Yeah, and you can also have an organ disease or structural problem and a neuroplastic condition at the same time, which can be very confusing diagnostically. For example, you could have rheumatoid arthritis, which we know is going to cause pain in your joints, but maybe the pain is a lot worse than you would normally see with rheumatoid arthritis, and that it's a lot worse because you have a neuroplastic contribution. I've had a number of patients over the years also who had both an inflammatory bowel condition and irritable bowel syndrome at the same time. And when they had a flare-up of their symptoms, we'd have to carefully investigate to see, well, is it the inflammation that is taking off here, or is it the irritable bowel syndrome that's taking off? And sometimes you have to treat both of them to get a successful outcome.
Have you used any tools? Like, there's a lot of, I guess, health tech out there now in the, you know, I guess, like, biohacking sphere or whatever. Like, have you used any of the tools that try to interact with the brain energetically or through different frequencies to try to regulate the nervous system? It maybe in conjunction with these other strategies to help like, have synergies?
Yeah, we haven't found it to be really needed for people with this. These techniques are so powerful. I should point out that there's research now from leading centers across North America that have documented the effectiveness of this, what we call neuroplastic recovery therapies, these psychological forms of treatment. The Boulder Back Pain Study, for example, took 150 people with back pain for an average of 10 years, divided them into three groups. One group got the neuroplastic recovery therapy, and then there were two control groups. The group that got the NRT, their pain scores dropped by 75% in 4 weeks. And this is people with an average of 10 years of back pain.
Was this your organization doing this study?
We funded that one, but it was conducted independently. We gave the money to the University of Colorado at Boulder because they had a really outstanding lab there that could do this work. They also scanned people's brains before and after they got treatment and showed actual physical changes in their brains from all they got was 2 hours a week for 4 weeks of this, you know, new form of psychotherapy. It's quite different than cognitive behavioral therapy that's the prevailing norm across the country. We get into a lot of other things that you and I have been talking about today. And it was, you know, amazingly effective. And the two control groups, the pain barely budged. And now they've got 5-year follow-up from that study. Again, all they got was 1 month of treatment. And even after 5 years, their pain scores are way down.
So what did they show in the scans? Can you speak to what the what is like seen in the brain after?
Yeah, the that's not an area of my expertise, but they did MRI scans of the brain before treatment and after treatment, and there were anatomic changes that were documented in that. Along the same lines of the study in Chicago, where the pain lit up one area of the brain when it was acute, short term, and then as it became gradually chronic in a fraction of those patients, the area that was active in the brain shifted. So the point of that is that there are real physical changes underlying this. These are not imaginary symptoms. And the therapy can actually, you know, change the brain as well. So that's what neuroplasticity is all about, that the brain can physically change, you know, pretty much in response to learning anything. If you have somebody that doesn't know how to ride a bike, scan their brain, they learn how to ride, their brain's going to be different. There are going to be different circuits up there.
Have you tried this on people where there is a clear physical thing going on that contributed? Like, let's say, you know, somebody gets a concussion and creates a stress, alters their brain, but then they change their brain through something that's not really, you know, putting something in the brain, if you will, or...
Yeah, it's. I haven't seen studies of traumatic brain injury, but it wouldn't surprise me if some of those patients were responding to this approach. I've definitely seen people with ulcerative colitis, as I mentioned before, inflammatory bowel disease, that did not get better when their inflammatory bowel disease was successfully treated with standard pharmaceutical approaches, and it was because they had an irritable bowel, which is a neuroplastic condition, at the same time. And by treating the irritable bowel with the approaches that we've been discussing today, that was when their symptoms finally improved.
What's the difference there? You said irritable bowel as opposed to
inflammatory bowel. Yeah, inflammatory bowel, you look inside with a colonoscope or with a small bowel x-ray, and the lining of the bowel is inflamed. I mean, it just looks red and raw, and it's obviously abnormal. Irritable bowel, the lining of the bowel looks fine. It's the muscle contractions of the intestines that are being thrown off by nerve signals coming down from the brain. And the bowel itself is sending signals back to the brain that it's interpreting as painful.
Interesting. I didn't realize those were, I guess, different things.
Yeah, the reason for the confusion often is that both conditions are sometimes referred to as colitis, but the actual meaning of the word colitis means inflammation. The itis part means inflammation.
Well, it's also, they're both IBS.
The technical difference is that we call one of them IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, and that's the one that looks red and raw and inflamed.
So that's like Crohn's or ulcerative colitis.
Or ulcerative colitis, that's right. And then the IBS is irritable bowel syndrome rather than disease.
Which is just symptoms of your stuff not functioning well.
That's right. A disordered motility, muscle contractions of the bowel, but no actual visible physical damage to the organ. But inflammatory bowel disease, there's visible physical damage to the organ. But irritable bowel syndrome, the organ is just not working the way it's supposed to, but it looks fine.
And that could show up in all kinds of ways, like bloating or pain or whatever.
Bloating, and if it affects the stomach, you know, nausea, vomiting, bloating, abdominal pain, pain that moves from place to place, diarrhea, constipation. Some people have diarrhea alternating with constipation, depending on whether the muscle contractions are propulsive or not. So, yeah, a whole lot of different symptoms. Everybody's a little different.
Yeah, so, I mean, any stress could trigger that stuff. I mean, I know someone dear, close to me who, you know, one night of poor sleep and digestion is, like, totally disrupted. And what's poor sleep? It's stress. It's just another form of stress.
Yeah, stress is a very common cause of insomnia. And there are people who actually get physical manifestations of their stress while they're asleep. Teeth grinding or clenching is one. People can even have a panic attack in the middle of the night. And the reason is that the brain is still quite active when we're asleep. It's not like a coma where the cortical parts of your brain are shut down. The brain is still very active during sleep, and lots of things can be going on in the body because of that.
Fascinating. Well, David, I really enjoyed this conversation. If people want to learn more and see how they can use these tools to maybe help them or a loved one, where do they go? What do they do?
Yeah, symptomatic.me is our website, and we've put a lot of time and effort into the resources that are on there, starting with the self-assessment quiz that takes most people less than 3 minutes to do, and we'll give you a lot of information about whether you yourself or a loved one could be experiencing this condition. And then, you know, once you're there, we've got lots of resources for people, including monthly question and answer sessions for those who support us by becoming members. And we are working avidly to change the way healthcare is practiced so that people who have this condition will get the same quality of care as everybody else.
Do you have like a network of practitioners where somebody could find someone local or?
Yeah, there's a directory in there of people who have taken extra training to learn how to diagnose and treat this. We've got mental health professionals that on there, medical professionals. Many of them will see patients via the internet rather than in person, so you don't have to be geographically local to them. And there are several hundred that are on that list, and it's growing all the time.
That's great. Well, I appreciate you reaching out and taking the time to talk. I've enjoyed it. And for the listeners, always grateful for your listening. I hope you found value. And if you think it might be of interest to try to work on something you're dealing with, then I encourage you to check it out and see if it's a good fit, or send it over to someone that you think is going through something tough. Don't underestimate the power of what's going on underneath from your past. I've heard too many stories of success by looking under the rug and shining a light.
Yeah, the body is kind of like the indicator light on your dashboard that your engine has a problem. And if you focus on the body, it's like focusing on the indicator light instead of going to check under the hood.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we just, we've become collectively disconnected from the signals of our body. And, you know, just reconnecting and learning how to listen and understanding what it's asking of you.
And
could be life changing.
Thank you for bringing that message to your viewers. I appreciate it.
Sure. Honored to be a conduit for your message, David. I think it's great. I think what you're doing is great. And I think it's a great story, that first client, how it kind of bridged that gap from you from, I guess, like the traditional allopathic care. I love to hear stories like that. So I think it's great.
Yeah, I'm so glad I met that patient and the psychiatrist early in my career.
Yeah, I could see that. I could also see how you might feel bad for a little while of all the ones you've kind of overlooked because you didn't, you know, you don't know what you don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, many of my physician colleagues found out about this, you know, after they'd been practicing for 10 or 20 years, and they're just smacking their foreheads about, they know they missed a lot of correct diagnoses over the years.
Yeah, well, you do the best you can with the tools you have at the time. And the medical system is a little bit handcuffed. They're not well equipped for all the things out there. But it sounds like
we're going to change that. Yeah, well, we are going to change that.
It's great. Well, I'm optimistic, and I'm looking forward to see how that system, what changes and how it unfolds in the future. Thanks again, David. Thanks again for the listeners. I hope you guys have a great day.